This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 4, Episode 30. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com and you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway. Welcome to the show, Garrows. There's a party going on in the background. What's happening there with you?
Well, bizarrely, I'm watching a rugby coaching session. We've got some music that's just dimmed off from the go-karting race course. This is on my right-hand side. And I've just finished a fitness session with the Forte Village fitness instructor. So it's all good. It's about 35 degrees, mate, and I'm sitting in the shade.
Fantastic. Well, that's the way to live, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I've got to do a bit of work this afternoon, but it's great. I'm watching Scott Quinnell, Shane Horgan and Will Greenwood take the rugby lads through their paces at this present moment in time. And then this afternoon, myself and Ian Salisbury will take the cricket boys through the nets and into some game situations. So looking forward to that.
Well, that sounds like a good way to spend the summer holidays. How long are you there for?
Oh, we're just doing a week this week, and then myself and Greens, Will Greenwood, are going back on Friday. We've got Sports Fest at Wormsley, at that fantastic cricket ground at Wormsley, where we've got five sports and a host of sports stars, ranging from Martin Johnson, Andrew Strauss, Will, Austin Healy, Tim Henman is with us. Jamie Oliver's doing the food. We've got music, and it's going to be great fun.
And speaking of having fun and learning a little bit about cricket, I was thinking a bit this week about cricket drills, because it's one of the things that is most searched for on Pitch Vision Academy. There's a lot of players out there. There's a lot of coaches out there who are hungry for ways to practice their cricket and get better at batting and bowling and fielding and the drills. There's lots of drills on the site, which are exciting, but one of the question marks that I have about these drills is you can get some brilliant ones, and you can get some not so brilliant ones, and you can get ones which seem very good but actually are not as effective as they seem. I always wonder, or I've started to wonder, I should say, about how you test the effectiveness of a drill when it comes to coaching a player or even doing your own drills as a young player and learning the game. Where do you come from on this, Gareth?
Well, as you, I'm evolving in that, because I think my understanding of how to test effectiveness is developing over the years. And I think, you know, when I started off coaching, you sort of go in with blind faith that it's going to work, you know, that any drill that you do is going to add value. But the parameters are quite significant, because as you say, you can get some really good drills, you can get some ones that aren't so effective, but yet we still keep doing. And also, we've got to take into consideration the individuals that we're working with at any given time, because one drill might meet somebody's parameters, yet his best mate who's standing next to him might not quite connect with that drill in the same way. So you know, there's lots of things to consider, but the bottom line is you need to over a period of time assess how it's affecting the game of cricket that's being played. And one of the things that does annoy me when I see some coaches work is that they try a drill once or twice and then just leave it. And the bottom line is that, you know, for a drill to be effective, whether it's a brilliant drill or just a good drill, it needs to be repeated enough to give the person the opportunity to take that into their game and put that out on the pitch. And the chopping and changing nature of some coaches, which I know that I've done in the past as well, doesn't often lend itself to that player actually going out on the pitch and being able to display what he's learnt in that drill. So stick with your drill, but then when it comes to effectiveness, what impact and what effect are you seeing on the person's play? So an example of that would have been a great example would have been England going to India recently, where the drills that they were working with were simple throwdown drills with the aim of either hitting the ball as close to the ball bounce as possible or as far away from the ball bounce as possible, and never ever attacking from that middle ground that English players have been playing from in the subcontinent for many, many years. And they practiced it religiously, and it just became evident that they outbatted the Indians in their own condition as a result. Well, in terms of drill effectiveness, that is 100% success rate. But they stuck at it. They stuck at it. They kept measuring. They kept saying, "Is this the right thing to do?" And eventually, it came through with a, you know, with a significant series win at the end of it.
Yeah, it's an interesting area because for me, it's very easy as a coach, as an individual coach, to look at the effectiveness of a drill based on limited information, the amount of people that you have in front of you trying the drill, the amount of time, like you said, Gareth, the amount of time that you try the drill for makes it difficult to make a completely rational assessment about something because you've got the bias of your own opinions, and you've also got the bias of what's happening with the particular set of young players in front of you. So when you come across a new drill, and perhaps your instinct, Gareth, might be, well, I'm not sure how that's going to fit in, or I'm not sure whether that's going to work in the way it's supposed to. How much chance do you give it with the group of players that you're working with before you think to yourself, okay, this isn't working, let's move on? Because there's also the pressure of, you know, having to come up with things that keep the players interested as well as just keep them improving.
Yeah, really good point. I think what I do before I start using a drill is I run it through in my head and think, you know, is this actually a really good drill? Is it going to connect with the players that I'm working with? And secondly, you know, from a contextual perspective, is it something that I want us to be better at? Is it something that's really important to us getting better as a team, or that individual improving as a player? So I think about those things before I take any drill in. But then once I've got through that stage, I suppose it's a filtering process. Once it gets to that stage, I will give it a period of time. And inevitably, because we're all good coaches, because we're all intuitive people, we tend to adjust the drill fractionally as we go through, and we use our experience to impact upon that. And then the drill has a meaning to it. Or you give it a go for 4 or 5 sessions or 3 or 4 sessions, and then you go, do you know what? Actually, it's not that important after all. And then you shift on to something else. So I'll give it at least 4 or 5 sessions before I write it off. But I do have that filtering process before I even get round to showing it to any player.
I think, again, it's a matter of being mindful, isn't it? Of saying to yourself, what is the goal of this particular drill? What is the goal of this component within a drill? One thing that I see quite often is the use of equipment because it's there, rather than any thought of, well, what's this going to be doing for us? So if you've got an agility ladder and you want to put it into a fielding drill because you've got it, then that's a bit different from saying, okay, what is the reason that I'm going to put this fielding ladder into this fielding drill? And often, if you ask why more than once, then you find that the answer is not quite as simple as you say. So going back to the example of an agility ladder, which, by the way, I'm not particularly against, but it's a good example of a piece of equipment being used because it exists. Why are you using agility ladder? Well, I want the players to have fast feet. Well, what does that really mean? I want them to be able to run faster. Well, an agility ladder isn't going to get someone to run faster. So do you really need the agility ladder in this build, or should you just be doing a 20-meter sprint?
Yeah, that's a fair point.
So that's my, whenever I come across any kind of drill or any kind of idea or training method, I always say to myself, why, more than once? Because one why often doesn't give you as detailed a response as you want. So you say to yourself, okay, fast feet's a classic example. What does that really mean? And is an agility ladder going to give somebody fast feet? I would question that as a coach. And then I would say, well, I probably would look at another method to be doing that doesn't require that piece of equipment. Keep the agility ladder to one side for something else.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the bottom line with any piece of kit is, what is my intention? Mm-hmm. What are we intending to do with this kit, and what is it going to provide us that we don't already have by using something more basic or even another piece of equipment that you've got? But, you know, the intention is everything. And I can't get too far away from that, whether it's a drill or whether it's a technical intervention that you're making with somebody. What is the intention of the time I'm spending with this player in this practice, in this drill, or with this player?
Yep, and then keep reviewing it once you've got the drill in. Don't exactly just assume it's working. Make sure that you review it against every player. Not just the ones who are improving with it.
And exactly, and that's where, you know, your communication with each individual player is absolutely essential, because you find that, you know, you've got Johnny and you've got Johnny's mates, and Johnny loves a drill and it's working for him, and it's and having a positive experience through it, whereas Johnny mate can't connect with it, and then we have to adjust the drill or think of another drill to use to really connect with Johnny's mate.
Okay, let's finish off this section, head into the questions round in a moment. But before we do that, we're going to do our usual yes-no round, where we only get to answer yes or no to three questions posed. And by the way, if you want to send in one of your own yes-no questions, you can email us on coach@pitchvision.com or send us a tweet at PV Cricket Coach if you want to have your name mentioned in this section. So, Gareth, I'll be in charge of the questions this week. And then you answer first, I'll answer second.
Yeah, no worries, mate. There might be a bit of noise because the lads are coming over from rugby, but we'll cope with that.
We'll go with it.
Yeah.
Question one. Australian cricket needs an overhaul as much as English cricket did in 1999.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Question two. Poor pitches are a significant barrier to producing cricketers.
No.
No. Averages are a bad way to judge performance.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, it's time to answer your cricket coaching and playing questions in the questions section, the mailbag. And this week we have a couple of questions which are vying for the prize of an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the first question this week is from Sarvesh. And Sarvesh's question is a technical one to do with batting. He says, I have the habit of shuffling across the wickets when I'm batting. I try to flick straight balls through mid-wicket and always get out leg before. I take a leg stump guard, so can you please tell me how I should avoid shuffling?
Yeah, good question that, Sarvesh. It's a really interesting one. I read it yet last night and I was trying to think about different ways of going about this, to be honest. And standing on leg stump probably gives you even more reason to move across, because you feel that you need to cover your off stump. And every batter feels that they need to cover their judgment of line is taken from that position. And you talk to any of the great players about how they cover their line of the off stump, and obviously if you're standing on leg, that's your bat normally on leg, which often means that your head is outside the line of leg stump, so you'll be feeling as if you need to get across to that off stump, and that's probably why you're shuffling. So I would take the complete opposite approach and see if this works for you, and I'd think about taking a middle stump or even a middle and off stump guard and see what impact that has on your shuffle, because you'll know that you don't need to get as far across. So that would be my approach. I totally understand why the coach or why you have taken that decision, because from a sort of logic-y point of view, it does make a bit of sense. But actually, having experience of doing this, both as a player myself, but also with players that I've worked with, I would suggest you to go the opposite way. Take a middle and off stump guard, because the reason why you're moving so much is you want to cover that off stump, because that is so important for any batter. So go to middle and off, go to middle stump, whichever you feel most comfortable with, and give that a go. And I guarantee that you won't shuffle across so much. The other thing as well is obviously you need to start hitting the ball more to mid on than to mid wicket. And you know, whilst mid wicket players, there is a lot of them in the world that can do it. They tend to be able to meet the ball either very late underneath the line of the eyes or take it very early, as in a Kevin Peterson, who does that particularly well. But ideally, even when you talk to the guys like a Peterson, they're still looking to line up mid-on. So the more drills that you can do where you put two cones down between the line of the stumps and the line of mid-on and aiming to hit as many balls back through there. I used to work with Desmond Haynes a lot when I was younger, and he always used to try and get me to hit the ball back through there. You talk to Ravi Bapara, his first coach, talked to him about trying to hit the ball back to mid-on. But I guarantee if you start a middle stump or even middle and off and then try and work the ball back to mid-on rather than to mid-wicket, then you'll find that you'll be shuffling heck of a lot less.
I have two thoughts on it as well. The first of which is completely and utterly stolen from Gary Palmer, but it's a good one. It's have if you have access to a bowling machine, or even better, if you have access to a bowler who is a left-hander, then set up the bowling machine to left arm over swinging in. So the line is going towards off stump, and then it straightens onto somewhere around about middle and off, and that will teach you that getting into the right position, getting into that balanced position, is the way to be able to play the ball through mid on, because it's very hard to do anything else against that angle, that particular angle of bowling. So it's slightly moving away from what would be realistic practice, because obviously most bowlers are going to be bowling right arm over, probably swinging it away. But it gives you that difference in angle that might make a difference to you working out your balance and your head position, and if you're aiming to hit the ball through mid on, like Gareth said, or well, mid on, straight mid on early on, and then maybe you can widen that out as you get more used to the idea of playing with a straighter bat. But that's quite a good method to adapt. So using left arm over bowlers, or a bowling machine, or feeds from left arm over the wicket, is a swinging in is a really nice way to practice that.
Yeah, I like that, and also I like it because it's versatile practice. And the bottom line is that, you know, we shouldn't be going into matches or any match when somebody rocks up and bowls left arm, and we're not capable of playing it as well. So we want versatile cricketers that can adapt. So therefore, you know, working if you're going to do a bowling machine session, and we see it, don't we? You know, people will practice for months just right arm over, and then won't have a Scooby-Doo when a left armer pitches up. And bowls an over or two. So, you know, I think that's a great shout. In terms of the techniques that are associated with it, you know, give it a go and see what happens. And I like the versatility of Gary's drills. I think it gives us a nice adaptable batter, and that can only be a good thing. And if that has a positive effect on you not shuffling, then that's fantastic. But to me, the reason why you shuffle is because you feel the need to get over and protect your stumps, and to protect that off stump in particular. So that would be my starting point.
And that brings me on to my second one, which is what might be worth thinking about. I've never tried this, but it's just popped into my head, is getting that shuffle in a controlled way. So instead of doing it as a kind of bad habit where you're moving as the bowler's just about to deliver the ball, you do it as a trigger move to get into position before the bowler's bowled. Then you're still at the point of delivery, which is a really crucial point when you're batting, but you've still done your shuffle, which makes you feel comfortable. That may or may not work if you do like a back and across movement. See how that feels. That could be something, another thing worth trying. But as I say, I've never experimented with that. And trigger moves can be tricky, so that might be a more extreme way to go if any other method doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, trigger moves are tricky, or ready positions, or however you want to phrase them, are tricky, especially to talk about when we haven't seen the batter operate. So I'd never give advice directly saying this is a good trigger move or not, because to me, they're very individual. And the question is when the trigger move takes place, not what it is, in truth. And some players need to move way ahead of time to load their legs, like a Kevin Peterson, and other players need to move just prior to ball release, like a Ponting or an Andrew Strauss. You know, I'm not going to give you any advice on that. All I'm going to say is it's a very individual thing. And to me, if you reduce the distance where you're standing in your off stump, then you're going to reduce your error content. And that's as simple as messages that I can give you today for you to go and practice with, Shavesh.
Good luck, Shavish. Let us know how you get on. The next question is from Luke, and this is quite a general question, but I thought it might open up a discussion, which is, how can I improve my fast bowling? Just by bowling in the nets, or are there any drills? So he's given us two options: bowling in the nets or drills. How will that improve his fast bowling, if at all?
Well, I mean, they all pay a part. I think we're both going to come from a strength and conditioning angle, because that probably is the biggest influencer on somebody's fast bowling, because it's such a robust and powerful part of our game, and unless you're physically robust enough to be able to deal with that, you're not going to improve at a rapid rate or not. So that would be my first thing. And we've talked at great lengths about the core and about leg strength and about that you can do in terms of strength and conditioning to build up your ability to withstand the ground forces and to transfer momentum up into the ball. There's heaps of articles that we've put out on here over the last couple of years on that. Net bowling is important, but as I said earlier, it's what is your intention every time you go to the nets? So is it that I need to increase my pace? I would say that drills would be better for helping you to increase that pace, and the nets are there for you to prove to yourself whether that pace is improved or whether your accuracy is improved. Because I always use nets as an opportunity to practice your match play rather than actually to develop a technique. I think drills are much better for developing technique. And then when we go into a net, we're practicing match play. So then when we go onto the field, we go in with confidence that we can just show off on the field. You know, the field is like a stage to an actor. It's their opportunity to show off and to perform rather than the place to work on your ability to play in match play. So that's why I use nets for. I think good drills. You know, you've got Ian Ponce, was it 3 10 pegs? Is that what he calls it, David? That you can probably talk about a bit more.
Yeah, the 4 10 pegs, yeah.
4 10 pegs, yeah, that you can talk out with great length. But I do a lot of work with people on for little trampets, because back leg to me is really important. How the back leg withstands the ground forces is crucial. So we do a lot of stability work on trampets and jumping off of trampets and bouncing on the back leg on trampets and then go into a bowling action. We do a lot of work with small medicine balls as well, which I think are really, really valuable, because to propel one of those at great pace means that you need to get your action in a strong position. But generally, I'd say strength and conditioning is a really good starting point, because without that, you're not really going to be able to use those ground forces most effectively.
Yeah, the Ian Ponce 4 10 pace is a really good place to start when it comes to technique, because it's the four positions, the four strongest positions you can be in for generating the maximum amount of pace. So it's a nice place to start. It's interesting. It's called a drill, but in many ways, it's not really a drill at all. It's it's almost like a tool to learn, because you're learning the four different positions that you need to be in, but then you have to go and practice those positions with drills rather than using 4 10 pegs as a drill, if you see what I mean.
So how, talk to me about that progression then from that, because that will probably help hugely in answering this question.
The 4 10 pegs, just to quickly describe what they are, it's a little bit difficult with audio, but just to describe what they are, the first one is back foot landing. So if you can imagine a bowler who's just landed on his back foot and he's still in that position where you know, the coil position is what it used to be called, probably still is, but you can imagine that. So that's the back position. The second position is halfway to releasing the ball. So you're almost like a starfish, in a starfish position. Your front foot's landed, your front arm is out and down, and your back arm is pointing back towards the opposite sight screen. As Ian Ponce says, you're touching the sight screens. It's a stretch position. The third position is ball release. So you've got your weight completely on your front foot. You're driving your hip through. The front arm is coming over, the bowling arm is coming over, and the front arm is pulling around, so you're level, so you're completely facing onto the batsman. And then, you know, as Ian Ponce says, all bowlers are front on bowlers as when they release the ball. And then the fourth position is to follow through.
Yeah.
And so you can, just by adopting those positions statically, that gives you the static feel of what each position should feel like when you do it dynamically and do them all together. And then you simply try and put those together with walking it through, and then jogging it through, and then running it through.
Yeah. And those are the usual progressions, aren't there? To increase your momentum after you've learnt something at walking pace, and then jogging pace, and then fast pace. And obviously, if it breaks down As you increase the pace, then you revert back to the previous one. So if it breaks down at jogging, then you go back to walking, you really work at that, you galvanize your learning that, then you try to stretch it and see if it handles the increase of pace and increase of momentum, increase of ground forces. And then if you've done that at jogging, then you progress it up into running, you get that right, you take it into a net, you put it into a net and see if it stands up to competition. Because obviously that brings another element into it. And then once you've done that and you're confident of being able to do that in competition, you go and take it into a match, and that's the stage where you perform.
That's right. And the key, and as Ian says in his Ultimate Pace Secrets book, which is available on Pitchfish Academy, the key is to start without anything. You start without a ball. You start without a net. You start without a pitch. You start with nothing. Because it's all about the feel. And then you just gradually introduce these more complicated elements until you get to a point where your action is grooved to the allowing for maximum possible pace. And sometimes, as you say, Gareth, it is a matter of going back a step. If you can't quite get it right at a jog through, then going back to a walk through and so on and so forth. So it's a long process, especially if you're talking about making large changes to an action. That can be quite a long process. Smaller changes, not so much. Or learning the action in the first place. The 4-10 pegs is a great little tool for younger players learning how to bowl. So it's technique-wise, you can do a lot of drills and a lot of stuff on your own. That's one of the great things about being a bowler, is that you don't need anybody else to practice with. You just need a ball and some space, and you can get instant feedback on what's happening by seeing what comes out when you bowl it. Being a bowler is one of the better skill sets to have to be able to practice if you don't have anyone else to practice with. The nets, I wouldn't worry if your goal is to bowl fast. I wouldn't worry so much about nets. Nets are almost a way, as you said, Gareth. Nets are almost a way to test what you think has worked when you're working on drills and when you've spent time in the gym, and then you come up to the open-ended situation of having a net against a batsman who's going to do things that you don't expect, and then you can see how your methods have worked or not in that situation, which is most close to a match.
Well, hopefully, Luke, you've got some ideas there that you can take away and implement into your own practice.
I tell you what, it's an easy game, isn't it, when you sat here talking about it?
Oh, especially in 35 degrees, mate. It's lovely.
Okay, let's move on. It's time to head to the newsroom for this week's Pitch Vision headlines with Daisy Cutter.
Thank you, David. Hi, I'm Daisy Cutter, and this is the Pitch Vision News. IPL outfit Rajasthan Royals are taking selection to the next level with the help of Pitch Vision. The franchise assistant coach Monty Desai is using PV1 in Jaipur to analyse players in training as part of their selection process. The countdown to the IPL 2014 starts now. Melbourne Grammar School, led by head coach and St Kilda player Tom Morris, managed to fit in a quick session at the PV Batting Studio in central London during their recent UK tour. The tour covered the length and breadth of the UK and saw the schools compete in 18 fixtures. Top MGC player was Simon Wilkins. He took 14 from an over from the English bowler. Pitch Vision interactive users continue to reach milestones this week. Users Marshall and Pollard have both reached 100 runs in the nets. And Indian bowler Joynal has taken over 50 wickets on Pitch Vision. Congratulations to all three. For more details on these stories, check out the show notes at pitchvision.com. That's Pitch Vision News for this week. I've been Daisy Cutter, and now it's back to the panel.
Well, that's interesting news about the IPL and how far ahead that franchises are looking to plan and strategize for the start of the 2014 event.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, it shows it's got to work. And I think one of the advantages, and you look at Rajasthan Royals as well, that I've had a bit of contact with over the years. They've got advantage of having a lot of Indian players in their franchise, and also lots of players that actually are in India for a long period of time ahead of the IPL starting. So, you know, using bits of equipment like pitch vision within their training program, they'll be able to pick up a number of very key performance indicators, particularly from a bowling perspective, that will help them when they go into competition. So this week it's David's turn to get up on the soapbox and have a minute. I'm going to keep him to a minute. He's normally pretty good on it, but I'm going to run the clock as of now.
As you know, I've been playing cricket, club cricket, for many years, and I've seen a sad demise over the years of a certain type of cricket, which is single innings, one day cricket, but where the draws are possible. It's quite unique to English cricket, but it's sort of dying because we played a game this week where we were bowled out for a low score. We had to win by bowling the opposition out, and we managed to do it. And we managed to do it because we set attacking fields, we set intelligent fields, and it was exciting right up until the end because they were well ahead of the rate, but we managed to bowl them out to win the game. But these days, most games, certainly in the league that I play in, are played as if it's win-lose cricket anyway, and draws just end up as boring cop-outs of teams who aren't quite good enough. So my plea is to either make draw cricket exciting or to get rid of draw cricket altogether, because it's a waste of time otherwise. Okay, that's just about all we've got time for on the show this week. So you've got to let Gareth get back to the party. But before you go, Gareth, we've got a competition winner to decide on. So Sarvesh and Luke are on the edge of their seats now. Their podcast playing who's going to be the winner. Sarvesh is shuffling across question or Luke's fast bowling question.
Well, this is a really tricky one this week because in terms of the question, I think Sarvesh's question is a better question. However, good questions and really good questions bring the best answers. And I thought that we answered Luke's question really well. So this week I'm going to go for Luke's question. I think Sarvesh is probably a bit hard done by on that, but I thought it got us to a point where we answered it pretty well. So that was more down to his question than our knowledge probably, mate. So I'm going to give it to Luke.
Congratulations, Luke. An online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy and pitchvision.com is on its way to you. Now, Gareth, if somebody wanted to send in their question, have it answered, rightly or wrongly, we're not sure, but definitely have an answer of some kind, and also win a prize, which is an online coaching course, what would they have to do?
They could give us a call on 0208 816 7691. Or they could drop us a line on email at coach@pitchvision.com.
Yes, indeed. There's also a Twitter, a PV Cricket Coach, and there's a Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. If you want to listen to the show every week, then you can subscribe to us. It's free. It's every week. It's gone for 220-some shows. So by now, you're hopefully getting the hang of it. Just head to iTunes, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us in there. And if you don't want to use iTunes, go to pitchvision.com/academy. Click on the podcast link and you've got the details for subscribing in whatever other podcatching device that you have. Internet toaster, whatever it is. So that's all for this week. So until next week, we'll see you next time. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, fella. Take care.